Patrick Henningsen and TNT.
All right, folks, welcome back. Welcome back. Second hour. Here we go. Got a brilliant hour ahead of us. And what a fantastic. I'm so pleased to be able to speak at length with Jose Vega running for U.S. Congress. We need more people like that running for office, folks. I'll tell you what, if he gets in there on this election cycle, that's going to throw a major spanner in the works of the war machine. He is articulate. He is up to date, and he understands the push and pull of these complex issues. And he's only 25 years old, or right around the minimum requirement to run for office, way ahead of Alexandria Ocasio-Cortez in terms of political awareness at that age. So I'm tell you what, I'm very impressed. But he needs all the support he can get. So if there's any way you want to support Jose and what he's doing, not even financially, but just in terms of sharing his content, spreading the word, it's greatly appreciated. It's really great to see the young people engaging on that level of politics. Fantastic. I can't say any more. But we will talk to him again in the future and get an update on where things are at. He's on the pulse of so many important issues as well. Great news to hear that Robert Fico, the Slovakian prime minister, will be getting out of intensive care, out of the ICU, stable condition, will be returning home, according to reports, this week. Obviously, he's under observation from the medical team there, but it is great to see that he is coming out of that. It'll be very interesting to see what his first speech will be when he does finally speak to the public. That's going to be fantastic. Really looking forward to getting that news as well. So we're all happy to see that. Other good news I want to report before we go to our guest, Tony Gosling. Julian Assange wins his right to appeal. He is going to appeal the U.S. extradition case. So consider this a small victory. Obviously, this could take another couple of years. I mean, the very least, will they please take him out of Belmarsh prison and let him be at home with his family? If they want to slap an ankle bracelet on the guy, he hasn't committed any crime. He's been in a Category A prison, unconvicted, for a very long period of time. At some point, this has to end while he does his appeal. And I think this is a very positive development for him, his family, and all of his supporters there. And it is a poke in the eye to the United States, who was just frothing at the mouth, along with the collusion partners in the British deep state, to extradite him to the U.S. in a national security court, where they most certainly would love to throw him away and throw the key away as well in a federal penitentiary somewhere. That's not going to happen right now. So we're very happy to see that development. So as much as the tragedy over the weekend has moved people in Iran, there's also been some positive news as well. Now, I want to welcome on to the stage an independent journalist and author, Tony Gosling from Bristol in the United Kingdom, joining us on the live link right now. Tony, great to have you with us.
Hi, Patrick.
Firstly, Tony, I mean, good news. Let's hit the good news first, because there's plenty of other things that we're going to be covering, but there are maybe slightly less savory. Robert Fico, Slovakian prime minister, major assassination attempt. I consider this to be a significant political event. Your thoughts on this and the good news that he is pulling through and he's out of danger right now. But how do you view that event?
Well, look, it seems this and the Raisi crash could both be the West, a kind of summer of hate in a kind of Orwellian style here. I'm looking at particularly in Slovakia, what you've got is you've got the rubber hitting the road there, because you've all the policies that the US and the UK and NATO generally are trying to roll out to destabilize Russia. Operation Beluga, revealed by one of the French intelligence a decade or so ago, this plan to destabilize Putin, target Putin, go for Russia. You know, Napoleon's failed, Hitler's failed, but we're going to do it. It seems pretty obvious to me, looking at the background of the guy that they tried to kill, and also worth mentioning that the police didn't shoot him dead. They arrested him so they could find out who he was and why he was there. And this is what police are supposed to do. That didn't happen in France at the weekend with the guy who attacked the synagogue. He just gets filled with lead and put in a coffin. So there's no more questions asked about who he was and where he came from. But no, it's lovely to see. It's a minor miracle that with four bullets in the stomach, I believe, that Fico's managed to survive this. You know, he's been the establishment in Slovakia even has been after him right since the COVID days. He was a vehement campaigner against the strict lockdowns, saying, quite rightly in my view, saying that these are over-the-top measures, that countries have been bribed by the IMF to take up these measures, and by, of course, the international pharmaceutical industry. So he's a kind of populist. He's a bit of a Viktor Orban or whatever for Slovakia. And it doesn't surprise me to see that he's being targeted by the NATO countries. I think the Russians also, when I say the rubber hits the road, these are the guys that are going to live next door to the Russians. They don't want to have America's war. They don't want to have the British war with Russia. And they understand, just as many military veterans across the Western world understand, that you don't want to pick a fight and have a war with Russia. So he was considered to be pro-Russian, even though he was actually a moderate anti-Russian. Interesting and great to see that the guys managed to pull through. I hope they tighten up their security in future.
Just on that topic, I want to move on to some of these other important stories. But Tony, I mean, you have studied, you understand the scope of Operation Gladio as a sort of clandestine interest over the 1960s, 70s, 80s, and 90s, maybe even to the present day. Let's be realistic. These things don't just get mothballed. Would you look at the attempted assassination and some other strange events that have been happening around Europe and even in Russia itself, terrorist attacks, would you consider looking at those within the Gladio lens?
Definitely. Yeah, Operation Gladio, anyone hasn't already watched it, the three-part Time Watch program by Alan Frankovich, which went out in the early 1990s on the BBC, did a brilliant job in looking into what that was in the history. I always remember one of the interviews, the guy said, we were told this was the most secret thing that was ever happening and that we would never have to breathe a word about it. Basically, it was fascists being recruited by NATO to carry out bomb attacks on members of the public. Largely, this wasn't so much political assassinations as attacks on banks, building societies, supermarket attacks, to make it look as if you've got a kind of fanatical opposition terrorist cell in the country that you had to deal with and bring in special measures and, you know, whatever, states of emergency, that sort of thing. Actually, it was all run by the state. And in Italy, the P2 Lodge, the Propaganda Due Lodge, was a major part of all of this. The problem was many of these countries were starting to foster big ties with the Soviet Union in the 80s. So NATO decided we are going to make sure that doesn't happen by blowing up ordinary Europeans and trying to blame it on the Russians effectively.
It does strike me, Tony, that we're in that kind of Cold War, a little bit like that Cold War dynamic or communism versus Western
getting,
capitalism.
Patrick, it's getting hotter. It's getting much hotter than it was in those days. What with these nuclear treaties being torn up by the Americans and the Russians saying, well, if you're not going to negotiate. The other thing is the fascist connection, because Gladio originated actually in the SS and in the Nazis, with what was called the werewolf program of the Nazis, the stay-behinds in World War II. As the Allies advanced, they wanted to have these fascist units pop up behind the Allies and carry out sabotage. That was the original plan, and NATO just took that Nazi plan. And of course, the guy that made an attempt to kill Fico in Slovakia last week, he was associating with these Ukrainian Nazi groups. So as you can see, the Nazi scourge is actually alive and well now in Europe. And the idea is that the mainstream media just is turning a blind eye to it and actually effectively covering it up. It's only shows like this where these things get actually properly discussed and talked about that we do have a serious problem now in Europe again with Nazis, which are being funded by that, particularly through NATO organizations, but they are being used for kind of special operations, and it could quite easily be that this guy was put up to it by them. I mean, they always say lone wolf, don't they? But I just don't believe that that's the case. I think we're really dealing with, and I've written a book about this. You may know, Patrick, if I haven't sent you a copy, I'm sorry, I will do. But it's about this Fourth Reich. It's called The Traitors of Arnhem, and it's linked to the Bilderberg conferences that came out of World War II, chaired by a former SS officer, effectively a Fourth Reich, really, in a nutshell. The Allies were doing deals, particularly the British, which many people don't realize. That Churchill and Desmond Morton, his private secretary, were doing deals with Martin Bormann, who was the holder of the Nazi loot before the end of the war. And then after the war, this money was laundered into massive companies to create a kind of financial Fourth Reich. So they were using banks and big financial institutions rather than tanks to take over markets and take over countries, take over institutions. They've been doing that since 1945.
Yeah, there's so many parallels as well to the things that you're describing there, and some of the same types of shady organizations, gangs and counter gangs, if you will. The Ukraine situation has really proliferated the potential for this problem right across Europe as well. So the conditions are very ripe for another round of Gladio 2.0. And I dare say this is kind of like what we're seeing the beginnings of now. This could go on for a very long time. So I think it's worth understanding history, Tony. I think it's valuable to analyze what happened, because we see some of the same patterns, the same organizational structures, the same sort of political dynamics as we saw before, slightly different today. But structurally, you can see the mechanisms that are working that are similar. And that's why I think it's valuable for us to discuss these things to better understand what we're looking at now, rather than just these random events.
You almost couldn't make it up that a couple of months ago, where you had this former SS guy turning up at the Canadian Parliament and getting a round of applause. In a way, what's happening is the financial and political elite are making fun of us. They're saying these people don't know their history. So that's one of the reasons why, I think it's important that we do. You know, George Orwell, his famous quote about controlling the past and controlling the present and the future. There's a massive effort still going on to control the narrative of what's been going on, particularly in Ukraine since World War II, where the CIA and MI6 have been supporting Nazis. That's what they've been doing. They were trying initially to destabilize the Soviet Union. But now these have all been turned on Russia.
That's right. And we have, troops from Ukraine, from some of these battalions, being trained in European countries by NATO armed forces in France, Belgium, in the UK as well. The head of the Ukrainian armed forces, who looks like he's auditioning for Ukrainian ambassador to the UK, is General Zaluzhny. I mean, pretty incredible stuff.
Yeah. But I mean, I think for me, looking over the last 24 hours at this plane crash, the helicopter crash, if you don't mind talking about that, it's in Iran. By 3 o'clock this afternoon, the BBC had stopped using it on its bulletins. It popped back up on the 6 o'clock bulletin. They were much more interested in a big story going on here in the UK about the infected blood scandal. But look, this is a massive, massive question. Even Jeremy Bowen, the BBC's Middle East correspondent, raised the issue of, was this Israel that did it? And he said something along the lines of, I can't think of a good reason why the Israelis would want to kill the president of Iran. Look, they've been gunning, as you and I know, Patrick, for many years to get this war going between Iran. This is the way that the far right in Israel, particularly the Greater Israel bloc, intend to expand the territory of Israel, is through war. And that's why they want to get, one of the reasons anyway, they want to get a war going. They also want to bring in far more money from the United States and their supporters in Europe to support them. So that's another reason they want war. Netanyahu wants to stay out of jail. We've just seen the International Criminal Court calling him a war criminal, potentially putting out very soon an arrest warrant for the guy. So he wants to stay out of jail, another reason to keep the war going. And so there are all sorts of, there's always this means, motive and opportunity. The motive is most definitely there, Jeremy Bowen, if you didn't see it. But there's another deeper thing, I think, that I haven't heard anyone else talking about. And that is the sort of spiritual aspect of taking out a president of Iran, if it has been done deliberately. And certainly there are some pretty strong indications it may well have been an assassination of Raisi yesterday. Is this idea of because everybody in that region of the world, many people do believe in God. This is in the back of their mind a lot of the time, even though you won't see it on the news. But what you will get in Israel is there'll be a sort of quiet celebration going on in the hearts of many Israelis. God is on our side. Look, the president is plain has just fallen out of the sky. And the same exact thing, of course, going on in Iran is it undermines the leadership when the population can see their leaders dying and not knowing if this is the Israelis or the West or whoever behind it. And so it has an enormous spiritual effect under the skin of the populations, upping the morale of the Israelis, destroying the morale of the Iranians. And so Jeremy Bowen, I think, needs to do a little bit of, maybe he should go and do a Reiki session or something to get into some of the deeper spiritual aspects of what's going on in particularly with this conflict. And I noticed the BBC yesterday evening did a, I think, brilliant little piece. Maybe it was by accident, but it was the BBC Persian service going through a list of all of the Iranian senior Iranian military and political leaders who've died mysteriously in plane crashes over the last 15 years or so. There's been something like eight of them, like the transport minister, one of the heads of the army, all these people just keep. And the implication, Patrick, is what they're trying to sort of make everybody think is, oh, they just don't know how to look after airplanes.
Oh, they said because of sanctions, they can't get the helicopter parts and all this other stuff, which is not really true for this particular helicopter. But you're absolutely right. There are deep themes. There are deep themes running through these events, Tony. And of course, most of this is lost on the mainstream media punditry on this, but it's no surprise to us, of course. But you mentioned Bilderberg. I want to talk about Bilderberg 2024. You've got kind of an inside reading on what might be happening there. If you can stick with us after the break, I'd love to cover that topic if you're able to. But so I'm with Tony Gosling, independent journalist. We're going to talk about the Bilderberg confab on the other side. You're listening and watching TNT, Today's News Talk. We'll be right back.
TNT's Jason Olborn.
These strange political decisions being put upon us. Now, are we all going mad, or is there another side that's being suppressed to the point that, in fact, we're indeed facing a hidden hand that we don't quite know what the agenda is?
The border in the United States used to be porous. It took Donald Trump 3 years to close it. And now there is no border. There's 10 million people have crossed the border, and we have no idea who they are. It'll cost, some suggestions, $500 billion. They're demanding, they protest in Denver, they demand free food, free ethnic food, etc. We have 1 million foreign students, 250,000 from the Middle East, 250,000 from China. Half of the students that are arrested on our campus are not students. They tend to be from the Middle East.
Weekends with Jason Olborn on Today's News Talk, TNT. A better business tip from TNT Radio. The benefits of advertising on Today's News Talk, TNT Radio, should be clear to businesses of any shape or size. It can be accessed anywhere, anytime, by anybody, and is the perfect way to build brand awareness and stimulate digital activity. If you'd like more information about advertising on TNT Radio, simply fill out your details on our contact page and we'll be in touch. To find out more, go to tntradio.live.
Internet. A stream online.
TNTRadio.live. Today's News Talk Radio. TNT.
Welcome back, ladies and gentlemen. Welcome back. Second hour of this live broadcast. Very pleased to be joined by author and independent journalist in the United Kingdom, Tony Gosling, on the live link right now. And Tony, we're talking about this tragedy over the weekend in Iran. This took place in the eastern Azerbaijan province within the Islamic Republic of Iran. The president, Raisi, had just been to a ceremony with the president of Azerbaijan on Iranian territory at a joint dam project they've been building for many years. An impressive structure in itself. That's another conversation. But and then he departs by helicopter. Three helicopters depart. My understanding is that two of them took a separate route to another destination, but the president's entourage and helicopter, moved in another direction, and then met its untimely demise overnight. You know a few more details about this, Tony. Maybe if you can share your thoughts on this.
Yeah, it's one of those interesting things as a journalist. It's frustrating when you go onto the Iranian state channels and there's nothing much there really, because of course they're being very, very careful about what they release. The thing is, there are parts of the world you can go to, particularly India and Pakistan, which have good English language news, where they've got inside sources in Iran, and they are saying much more interesting, I think. I mean, of course, there's more of an aspect of speculation because there's now been an inquiry today set up into this crash, quite rightly. You're right about, I mean, for a start, you know, if I was in charge of the transport of the president, I would not be sending a single helicopter on its own across a mountain range. You've got to have some escort of some sort, really. Also, helicopter doesn't make sense to me. It's got to be a fixed wing aircraft. They're much safer, generally, less to go wrong. And so it is surprising that that such a trip would be taken. But, you know, the ceiling of the Bell 212 is, I had the great privilege for 5-6 years or so working at Biggin Hill Airport, which is one of the old Battle of Britain airfields in Kent, and picked up a lot about these choppers and all sorts of aircraft, really. And so 17,000 feet these things go, that's their operational ceiling. Unless you've got loads and loads of weight in there, you've got a few passengers, that should be fine. You're going to be mostly above the weather at that sort of height. And if there's an engine failure, something fairly simple, a helicopter is what they do is they auto-rotate. So as the thing starts to come down, the pilot knows what to do. You just free up the rotors and they spin all on their own. When you start to get towards the ground, you can increase the pitch on the rotors, bring the thing down slowly, and you can actually land a helicopter with no power fairly smoothly if you're a decent pilot. I'm sure they were. And the fact is that they would have been going down into cloud and mist and that sort of thing. So they wouldn't really have been able to see any potential landing spots until they were right on top of them. So that's a really dangerous type of situation. But we have heard some indications that there was no communication from the pilots, that there was no mayday, that sort of thing. Now, in that, you know, if you're having some sort of mechanical trouble and you're starting to go down, even if you're going into mist and fog or whatever, you're going to be sending a mayday out of some sort. You've got a co-pilot sitting there. He's not going to be twiddling his thumbs or, you know, whatever. He's going to be on the radio explaining we're having problems. So even if the thing has smashed to pieces when it hits the ground because you can't see anything as you're coming down, you would expect there to be radio calls. What were the sources in India and Pakistan I've been reading are saying there were no calls from the helicopter. And so that suggests some sort of catastrophic altitude. Something happened, whether it's could be a missile, could be electronic warfare, some sort of explosive device on the helicopter. But it's unlikely to be some sort of simple thing, which, I mean, if you're at that sort of height, I would guess they were probably cruising along around about 15,000 feet. That gives you a fair amount of time to do something, say something. And so initially, that's my first day's inquiry into this. Is it certainly to me right now looks like more likely to have been an assassination rather than some sort of mechanical or failure. Certainly not pilot error. That's just not the way you would expect things to happen. And it could even be that they just simply chose the wrong kind of transport to transport the president. And he could have gone by some other route, by a fixed wing aircraft rather than a helicopter, or even by surface. If you're going to go across mountains in a helicopter on your own with a president, I would say no, just don't do that. It might even be, though, and these things often happen, the president insisted, no, it's okay, I'm going to go. He may have said, I want to do this, even though it's a little bit dicey.
Yeah, no, you're absolutely correct. I just spoke to a pilot in the last 48 hours And he said that, yes, these helicopters are equipped to go through extreme weather and fog. However, it's unadvisable to proceed if the weather is really difficult and would provide, you know, pose all sorts of problems, especially if you're in difficult terrain, you know, away from or out of, you know, radio coverage or something like this. So like you said, Tony, it would have to be a case of that somebody within the team would have said, no, we need to move forward, need to get there. Only then would you want to proceed in such conditions in a helicopter.
The 212 goes up high. The 212 will go high. I mean, it will go over the weather mostly. I mean, unless this is really high cloud, they would probably be looking down on in the sun up there, looking down on a blanket of bad weather down below. But we're just not 100% certain what's happened. I just think the indications are, and of course the motives, as I was talking about earlier, you know, the motives definitely there. The Israelis will be cock-a-hoop over this.
Yeah, still a lot more questions to be answered. I think some information will come out, maybe, hopefully any information more in the next couple of days, weeks, who knows, maybe even years. But you're right, Tony, the sensitivity of this event in terms of what it means if it was announced that there was any foreign meddling or any involvement or subterfuge on this, there would be outrage and perhaps pressure within Iranian society to do something about it, to retaliate, in fact. So, and that just opens up a whole nother conversation, of course. But Israel normally doesn't admit, do they?
Yeah, they're doing the right thing. They're extremely cautious about making sure they've got all their facts straight in a line before they're making any kind of proper official announcement about what they think the cause is. Absolutely the right thing to do. But you can't stop the Pakistani and Indian journalists phoning up their contacts in Iran, thank God, and getting out some little leaks, things like what I've just been sharing.
Okay, well, we'll keep an eye on what you're reporting on this, Tony, going forward. And then over to the big meeting, the Bilderberg 2024 confab. You seem to know the location. Do we know the agenda? Who might be attending? What's your thoughts and read on Bilderberg this year, Tony?
Well, look, all I can say, I was at last year. I won't be at this year. It's just too hot for me, Madrid, this time of year. In Lisbon last year, we had David Lammy, who's going to be our foreign secretary by the end of this year in Britain, I think. I don't think there's much doubt about that. So the location is at a massive five-star hotel called the Eurostar Suites Mirasierra in Madrid. There's been a bit of sort of discussion amongst the Bilderberg chasers about why Madrid. And, you know, one of the things that's come out about this, Patrick, is we've seen pushback from the Spanish over both Gaza and Ukraine. So the Spanish government, for example, a couple of months ago, I think it may have been the end of last year, denied the Red Arrows, the RAF display team, permission to fly through Spanish airspace. So they had to cancel their big Gibraltar air display. So this is the Spanish putting diplomatic pressure on the Brits. Now, they won't say definitely that that is because of our support for the Israelis or for the Ukrainians. But it's quite clear that there is enormous political splits in Spain, that many, many factions who are now have been really for the last 6 or 8 months being very vocal about stopping any support for Ukraine. And the Brits have been pushing it. So you've got these political fissures, even though you've got one great big EU and one currency controlling all these countries. You know, of course, the currency is really what controls them, not so much the politicians. They're just a kind of like Punch and Judy show. But there are still these independent-ish governments, and the Spanish have really been pushing back in several directions, both on Gaza. And so also the Spanish were telling the British that they couldn't bring the HMS Queen Elizabeth, this massive new aircraft carrier, new-ish, but they couldn't bring that into through the Spanish waters, again making it almost impossible for it to come to Gibraltar. So there has been an enormous amount of pressure from the Spanish on the Brits, and I actually applaud them for that. I'd like to see all countries putting diplomatic pressure on Britain right now to sever all links with the Ukrainians, really, and to stop funding the Ukrainian Nazis particularly, and also of course the Israelis. So That's, I think, maybe why the Bilderbergers have decided to meet in Madrid, Patrick, even though I think they do decide these things maybe a year or so beforehand. The political pressure against, you know, particularly with Russia and Ukraine, against the NATO policy from Spain has been building for a couple of years. And it might be that they're just there to try and get the Spanish back in line.
So who do you envision attending? Who's on the high table these days? I know a few years ago it was Peter Thiel, and some of the big tech moguls had gotten into some of those captains of industry chairs that had been previously occupied by, you know, the steel magnates and some of the older industrial tycoons. What about now? How are the top committees looking now?
Well, it's changed a lot in my lifetime, actually. It started off with finance and oil. It's now finance and tech mainly. Obviously money is what it's all about. It's almost like the high priests of globalization, the Fourth Reich, trying to make sure that they kind of keep their story straight. You know, that's how I see Bilderberg now. I've been doing this for a while. 96 was the first one I covered. And you see the way they operate is they've got to come together face to face, first of all, because there's the sort of glitzy side of that, meeting all these celebrities like, you know, Mark Carney, somebody like that, you know, the former governor of the Bank of England, the head of regulation at the Bank of International Settlement, seeing all these super powerful people whose power actually does seem in a way to be waning because people just don't kind of respect them anymore or trust them so much as they did back in the, even in the noughties. So you've got, clearly, you've got these some really interesting characters are now part of, not necessarily on the steering group, but very influential within Bilderberg. One of them is Alex Karp from Palantir. Palantir is a fascinating and deadly organization. I mean, in a way, isn't it interesting? They've taken the name Palantir from the Lord of the Rings, you know, this kind of sphere. I'm sure most of your viewers know what it is. It's used to communicate in the world of Middle Earth between wizards in different towers, and even, you know, hobbits can use it it uses them usually. But to take these icons from the Lord of the Rings, I think, is a particularly sneaky and nasty thing to do. But Palantir, as a bit of software, it's the design of it is flexible. But the idea is, what you do is you put all the people and all the terrain and territory and where they are and their location data, and then you just crunch through these massive databases of profiles to find who you want, where they are, how can we pick on them, how can we influence them. And the software has now been adapted, although you might say that was what it was always going to be used for, to kill in Ukraine. So they're using this Palantir software, which revealed Christmas before last in 2022, in order to do targeting of Russians in the east of Ukraine. The idea is you link it up to the satellites, you find out where they are, you find out who they are, you find out concentrations of them, and then literally the AI for itself will start saying, well, you just send a drone and kill this one, send a maybe a missile at this one, artillery at this one. So a lot of the command and control is coming through Alex Karp's system, and he's one of the main people in this Bilderberg. And of course, last year in Lisbon, there was a massive we couldn't quite believe it. Yuval Noah Harari was in town at the time and denied he was at the meeting, but they were all talking about this human 2.0 and we're going to improve humanity through genetic engineering, and computers are going to be running the world, and that humans can just have a nice time, lie back, and let computers control things. What they weren't saying really was that we're living through the first ever real use of these software systems to run wars. And it's almost like when I very first ever saw a chess computer, I don't know about you, back in the 1970s, I think it was, I was thinking, well, this is a technology that could be used for all sorts of things, isn't it? And of course, the ideal is, because of the moral element of it being very difficult to get human beings to kill innocent civilians in wartime, even if they're drone pilots far away, it's very difficult to do it. People get, you know, they've got a moral conscience that you can't really unscramble. How much better to get Alex Karp's software, press a little button, and let them do it. And so, yes, Peter Thiel, yes, most definitely, he's one of the major figures there. You know, I think you've got to change from the old oil elite to this tech elite, because they need to control the narrative. They're failing to control the narrative. And so they've really got to make sure that all of these big tech giants are all on the program. And they are there to, I think, to simply dominate the planet to any whichever extent they can. They're obviously not doing too well with the Russians, and they're well behind schedule. So they're still battling away. I think they're basically, Patrick, I'll be quite honest with you, I think they're a bunch of losers. Ultimately, you know, they're doing what they can to privatize everything, to control governments, to manipulate governments. But the best laid plans of mice and men gang aft a glee. And they are definitely ganging after glee. Things are going wrong. It's not all going right for them in the Middle East. It's certainly not going right for them in Ukraine. And they're finding themselves getting less and less support at home. They're having to spend a lot of their time and effort in trying to control their domestic populations as well. And so, yeah, Bilderberg represents really the political wing of NATO. And I think they pretty much do control the politics in most of the NATO countries now. They've managed to maneuver their people into position. Like, I mean, even Sunak, he's Goldman Sachs. Goldman Sachs are one of the main banks, one of the major players in Bilderberg, and have been ever since the 1990s when I started looking at it. So I see Sunak as one of their little puppets.
And I don't know how much longer he has. His days might be numbered. But yeah, what you just described with Palantir, Tony, is pretty much chapter and verse of one of the recent James Bond films, Spectre, if I'm not mistaken. So this all-seeing eye system that is inside everybody's heads and pockets and all institutions and machines, it's we're not that far from there, Tony. It's pretty extraordinary.
Well, it gets a bit bleak sometimes, but do you know what? I honestly don't think humanity is going to take it. Maybe many people will suffer and die in their wars. Obviously, that's already happening in Europe and in the Middle East particularly. But there is no actual way, I think, and to totally break the human spirit. They think there is. They've convinced themselves that there is. And so, you know, there are academics who are speaking out. There are a lot of people out there, I think, who are going along with this on a kind of gravy train basis. But when it actually comes to sacrificing their entire morals and being kind of totally manipulated, so they'll do it for the money for a while. And then maybe they'll just walk away and say, I've had enough now, you know. And so the further they push it, the less. And I mean, King Charles, it has to be said, is a major, major player in all this. I mean, he is pushing. He's one of those people whose royalty does figure big time at Bilderberg over the years they have. I don't think he's necessarily ever been. He may well have been doing video links in and that sort of thing to the Bilderbergers. They have these massive. I mean, you don't know what's going on in there, really. They have a massive satellite tower. Usually on site, and so they'll be doing live links in with various people, possibly like him.
Lastly, just a couple of name drops if you think they might be in attendance: Zelensky, Ursula von der Leyen, and they sometimes audition the future U.S. president. Could be Robert F. Kennedy shows up or Donald Trump. On those points, your final thoughts.
This is ever so difficult to guess that. These are the people that they are behind the scenes hoping and grooming to be. So when that list comes out, and this is one of the reasons that, you know, it's important to actually get down there if you can and get photographs of people going in and out, because sometimes people are in there that aren't on the list. So it's ever so difficult to second guess it. I think what they tend to do is not send Zelensky, but send, say, for example, the Ukrainian foreign minister, somebody like that along, or, you know, some high bigwig within the Ukrainian government. Zelensky should, by the way, today is the final day of Zelensky's term as president. Why is he still president? He should be a civilian today, but there's been no elections, and he's banned 11 political parties. So you've got a dictatorship now in Ukraine as of today. This should be the main item on the news. Why have we got a dictator in a country that we're supposedly supporting? So it's really, I mean, you've asked me a really difficult. I said David Lammy. I think obviously there's going to be some senior people like Wes Streeting who are about to take over here in Britain with the Labour Party, because Sunak's job as the Bilderberg puppet is to sabotage and destroy the Conservative Party. Anybody that tries to call a leadership election is having very strange, weird things happen to them. And so his job is just to make a total mess of everything. And all that Keir Starmer and the Labour Party in Britain here have to do is sort of nod their heads, say a few platitudes, not commit to anything, and they'll win the election. I think it's one of the biggest fixes we've ever seen. In fact, it was about 18 months ago, one of my contacts from the PCS union, which is the civil servants union here in Britain, said to me, I was quite surprised, said, no, the Conservatives don't want to win the next election. I'm like, hang on. And now, of course, he's right. You can see. But the question is, why? And the answer to me, I think, obviously, they like to recycle Team A, Team B every once in a while. But I think that there's something big coming down the line. They want this to land on Keir Starmer and the Labour Party's lap rather than the establishment Tory party, in a similar way to 2008 landed on Gordon Brown's lap. What am I going to do about this? There's all sorts to play for here, but the politics is really gutter politics these days, Patrick, in the UK. What Sunak is up to is just sabotage the Tory party. That's his only job, and read from a script, which the idea that he's in any way in charge is obviously rubbish.
Well, the trilateralist, Keir Starmer, waiting in the wings.
Correct.
And to answer your previous question, I think Palantir is probably running the Ukrainian state right now. How long till they run Britain, Tony? That's the question we're all wondering.
Well, that's a good, really good question. I don't think they're going to completely get away with all this. Obviously, they're trying. They're kind of in a corner, really, because they're fighting foreign wars and they're also fighting their domestic population at the same time. But they're overly arrogant, and also they're surrounded by sycophants. Those sycophants might just ditch them any time. So they're not in a good place, put it that way. And so they're likely to do crazy extreme things, which will make things even worse. You know, it's good to see, by the way, this indictment and the potential war crimes of Netanyahu, because that's the way I think things are going to be straightened out. We've actually got a pretty good still just about judicial process with Julian Assange. Is a bit of a shame and it's a disaster, but there are some hopes with the courts around the world, and it's nice to see them occasionally standing up for themselves.
Yeah, there's some positive things to build on there. Tony Gosling, investigative journalist and author from Bristol in the UK. Tony, thank you very much for sharing your thoughts with us on TNT this week.
Cheers, Patrick. God bless to all your listeners as well.
There he goes, ladies and gentlemen. Keep an eye on what Tony's putting out, especially as Bilderberg approaches. That's where you want to be looking for that major event. We'll hopefully check in with Tony later in the month as that approaches or while it's happening. Listen, we're going to take a break right now with the network TNT, Today's News Talk. And when we come back, we will discuss the ins and outs of this Julian Assange appeal and other breaking news. Patrick Henningsen, your host. Stay with us, folks. We'll be right back.
I didn't ask to be thrown in the streets with nowhere to go. I didn't think I'd survive. But I did ask for help, and Covenant House was there for me.
1 in 10 young adults will experience a form of homelessness this year. For these kids who didn't ask to be put in this unthinkable situation, Covenant House is there.
Covenant House helped me break the cycle of homelessness in my family. They gave me the love that I needed.
Over 2,000 young people will sleep safely in a Covenant House bed tonight. When youth who are experiencing homelessness have a hot meal, a safe place to sleep, medical care, and love, they can overcome heartbreaking challenges and have a brighter future.
They just really genuinely just wanted to help me succeed, and I'm succeeding. I'm a speaker, I'm an author. Covenant House really helped me and really helped mold me into the woman I am today.
If you or someone you love is asking for help, go to safeplacetosleep.org today.
The thing that drives me every day as a dad is him. Every day he's hungry for something. And there's this huge responsibility in making sure that he's a good person. I think the advice I would give is you don't need to know all the answers. It's okay to make mistakes. As long as it's coming from love, then it kind of starts to work itself out.
Patrick Henningsen talks on today's News Talk Radio, TNT.
Welcome back, ladies and gentlemen. Welcome back. Great segment with investigative journalist Tony Gosling. I hit a couple of really important stories there, and Tony is very much up to speed on so many different topics, and some of the most controversial at that. Now, back to the Assange appeal. Basically, the UK High Court has ruled in favor of Assange's defense team on this. Pretty incredible stuff. WikiLeaks founder has the right to a full appeal process. How is this going to shake out? What's the timeline going to look at? That's the big question right here. You have to consider the fact that he's been held in a Category A prison, Belmarsh, Southeast London, as an unconvicted prisoner now since it looks like April of 2019. Thereabouts. So we're getting into, 5 years plus right now already. This is beyond a joke, but it's no joke for Julian and for his family, his supporters, and for anybody that cares about transparency, a free press, and what governments like the U.S. and other NATO states, what they're doing with the public money that they're accruing in order to wage wars of aggression, undeclared wars of aggression around the world, and so many of them at that, regime change operations, etc. London's High Court has granted the jailed WikiLeaks founder Julian Assange the right to a fresh appeal against a previous ruling that ordered his extradition to the United States for what looks to be trumped up superseding indictments, a whole bevy of them, in fact, double jeopardy. That's what he's being subjected to. That's what his defense has argued. This is what his advocates say. It's hard to argue with the facts on this. They seem to be correct. The founder of the free press website, WikiLeaks, is saying that his prosecution in the UK is part of a larger effort by the US to punish him for publishing leaked classified materials exposing war crimes, real war crimes by the United States. Unequivocally exposing them. And the fact of the matter is this, ladies and gentlemen. The fact of the matter is that those people who committed those war crimes on camera, in some cases, those who committed these war crimes have not even gotten so much as a parking ticket for what they've done. But the person who exposed the war crimes, a journalist working for an absolute global digital free press outlet called WikiLeaks, is being subjected to the most inhumane treatment and one of the largest stints of an arbitrarily detained individual in the modern era, according to the UN Special Rapporteur on Torture, Nils Melzer. This is chronicled in his great book on this subject as well. But if he's handed over to the United States on this extradition gambit, which itself is a violation of the bilateral treaty between the United States and Britain, which completely forbids extradition on political grounds. And he is a political prisoner by sheer nature of the fact that he has been targeted by the CIA. They have denied him due process. They have spied on him and people visiting him while he was having asylum in the Ecuadorian embassy in the United Kingdom. Not only that, a plot to assassinate him, as was exposed. Mike Pompeo involved in these things during his stint as head of the CIA and Secretary of State. So this is a political persecution. So if handed over to the U.S., you'd be kept in solitary confinement, no doubt. Treated like a terrorist. Treated like a Gitmo detainee. So Assange has been in custody again since April 2019, as I said. And when Ecuador, under U.S. pressure, revoked his political asylum, allowed the British police to do an extraordinary rendition on Ecuadorian soil, effectively kidnapping him and into custody and into a kangaroo court system. Why? Because, again, he published material that embarrassed the United States and NATO. material directly pertaining to the war in Afghanistan, which is widely regarded now as a total debacle and mistake by anybody with half a brain who's honest in the West and around the world. Assange has since kept, he's been kept in a maximum security, again, category A prison at Belmarsh. It's a prison for hardcore serial killers, murderers, and terrorists. And this is where he's been now since April 2019. And the American case against him was revealed only after he was arrested in the UK, which validates his own suspicions, which were played down at the time, that the trumped up Swedish sex case against him was a gambit by the US and Britain to try to get him extradited to the US. And they laughed about it at the time, if you remember. They said, oh, that's a conspiracy theory by Assange. He's got nothing to worry about. If he's innocent, hey, he's got nothing to worry about. He just turned himself in. They could have interviewed him by Skype. The Swedish authorities could have interviewed him remotely many times. They could have come to the embassy to interview him if he was a person of interest in this alleged sex crime case, which the Swedish prosecution dropped not once, not twice, but three times. It was revived more than once at the behest of the United States, no doubt. And as it turns out, the Crown Prosecution Service in Britain were going behind the scenes and applying pressure on the Swedes not to get, quote, don't get cold feet, end of quote. Who was head of the CPS at the time in Britain? Well, none other than the Labour leader, Keir Starmer, who looks like he was promoted for his good deeds. And those weren't the only good deeds he's done for the establishment. It's very interesting, isn't it, how politics works, how power works, and who is trampled underfoot? Julian Assange, as well as your rights to a free press, freedom of speech, and everything else that you hold dear in Western democracies. Ladies and gentlemen, isn't that the truth? American lawyers fought a legal battle against Assange. I was there during part of those court hearings at Woolwich Crown Court. Assange's defense team tore the U.S. mercenary prosecution to shreds. And not once, not twice, but three times. But that wasn't enough to sway the judges to keep him incarcerated in perpetuity, to the point whereby his health has suffered, his mental health, his physical health. It would be really convenient for both the US and Britain if he dies in custody. They can just wash their hands at that point, do a few retrospective TV specials about what a great journalist he was and say what an awful tragedy this was. And everybody can wash their hands of it, and nobody can be held responsible for this great miscarriage of justice. But the problem is this. The problem is the support for Julian Assange is not just in Britain. It's not just in America. It's global, because people around the world have recognized through this case that it crosses a major red line. And that red line is this, that the United States can extend its hand anywhere in the world against even a non-US citizen and extradite it. Why? For embarrassing the United States government by publishing information that is absolutely in the public interest and it is exposing some of the highest crimes on the planet. And for that, the United States can destroy that journalist, can destroy that publisher that's given them this license through their allies, through their, quote, junior partners around the world. They're able to exert universal jurisdiction. And not because they committed any crime. This was all litigated before with the Bradley Manning trial back in 2009, 2010. They revised it and trumped up a new set of superseding indictments to try to destroy Julian Assange, pure and simple. That's all that's happened here. Despite all the fancy cases made and convoluted arguments that are woven in Rupert Murdoch's Times of London or on CNN, on some of these other mainstream media outlets that threw him under the bus a long time ago. And only recently, some people have taken interest in the case. Why? because they've seen how many people care about this issue. And it's forced a lot of mainstream journalists, like those at The Guardian, to actually report what's going on with regards to the Assange case. They didn't want to do it. They were quite happy to chuck him under the bus with a trumped up Swedish sex case, etc., declare him persona non grata and let him rot away in prison. That's the way most of the political intelligentsia, especially on the left, funny enough, treated this for the longest time. Now they're waking up to it. Great. Now it's time to free this man, send him back to his family, let him get on with his life. Let us get on with our business of free speech and the free press. I'm Patrick Henningsen. Thank you, Tony Gosling. Thank you, Jose Vega. This has been a powerful program. Thank you guys for coming along for the ride. We'll see you tomorrow, same time, same place. Take care, you guys.